Well, welcome everybody back to another episode of the Chronicles Magazine podcast. I'm, of course, your host, CJ Engel, and I have with me today Lee Congdon. I'm particularly looking forward to this conversation because we're going to talk about someone who I think is really important and underappreciated, someone who has written a lot, has thought a lot, and contributed greatly to a critique of the 20th century in many ways. And that person, of course, is George Kennan, and I have with me Lee Congdon. So, Lee, thanks for joining me. You've written two books, at least, maybe more books, but I have two on George Kennan, and we're going to get into who he was and what he represents and why he's important to talk about. The two books I have here are this one, George Kennan, A Writing Life, and the second one, I think, is more recent, George Kennan for Our Time. So we'll get into a little bit about the differences between those books and who George Kennan was. But first things first, what brought you to interest in George Kennan?
I think I first got interested in Kennan when I was an undergraduate, and I had a professor who was very much interested in Kennan. And then he got me reading Hans Morgenthau's In Defense of the National Interest, and that was consistent with a lot of Kennan's views. After that, I always had a kind of interest in him. I would read books that he wrote. But in the meantime, I was writing a lot about Hungarian intellectuals. But in the early 80s, I went to the, became a visiting member at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And Kennan was still, he'd technically retired, but he was still at the Institute. So I was kind of eager to meet him, but I didn't know how to go about it. And John Elliott, who was a very distinguished, late distinguished historian of early modern Spain, said, "Well, you should, when he comes in for lunch, you should just go up to him and ask if you can join him for lunch." And I said, "You know, I don't think I can do that." And he said, "Well, everybody says that." And so he eats lunch by himself. So I didn't do that, but John was kind enough to invite my wife and me to dinner with the Kennans. And that was a marvelous experience. I learned a lot of what he was like sort of in person, and which was that he was very impressive. And we did have, I don't remember a lot about the conversation, but I do remember that we had, and I mentioned that to him, that we had one friend in common, that was John Lukács, the Hungarian American historian. He was close, very close to Kennan, and John was a good friend of mine as well. So it was, you know, that evening that I decided I definitely wanted to write about him. So I finished the last, it was a trilogy on Hungarian intellectuals, and then I retired in 2005, and that gave me more time to write. And so I started writing on the first book, which was George Kennan, A Writing Life, which I tried to say that, you know, he, although he was a very famous and distinguished State Department official and foreign policy expert, that deep down he really was more of a writer, that his, you can tell this from even his professional writings for the State Department, he always took great pains at polishing his prose and making it sound literary. Mm-hmm. And he was good, very good at that. Mm-hmm.
So how would you situate George Kennan? I mean, people may have vaguely heard about him. You know, what, generally speaking, he was a foreign policy guy. And we're also going to talk about some of his domestic interpretation too, but what things did he contribute in the foreign policy arena?
Well, he was one of the number of realists in foreign policy, among the most impressive of them. There was Morgenthau himself, Reinhold Niebuhr, who was a greatly impressed Kennan, and Kennan himself. So those were three of the most important of the realists. This is a outlook on foreign policy that's not in favor of really hasn't been for a long time, ever since Wilson ascended to the presidency. Now the foreign policy establishment is dominated by neoconservatives and liberal internationalists or interventionists. They come pretty close to the same thing. the neoconservatives are more willing to sort of act on their own and foreign policy, for America to act on its own foreign policy, and the liberals tend to want to work through the UN or international organizations, but they all have the same idea that it would be a good idea to impose on the rest of the world our way of looking at things politically, and that means for them mostly democracy and human rights.
Mm-hmm. Where did George Kennan come from? What's his background?
Kennan was came from a family from Scotland or Ireland originally, and their name was Mick Kennan, and then he dropped it to just a Kennan. And he grew up in Milwaukee and was a very Midwestern kind of person. He had an opportunity to apply to Princeton for college, and he did that mainly because he had read This Side of Paradise. Mm-hmm. That sort of moved him to go to Princeton, and but when he was there, he felt very much out of league with the rest of the people, among the students.
If I could interrupt for a second, what decade is this in when he's going at Princeton?
Well, this would be in the 20s, nearly 20s. Yeah.
Okay. And did he have any particular interest in foreign policy at that time?
You know, he didn't really have particular. He thought of going to law school after he finished at Princeton, but his grades weren't good enough. So then he thought of the new State Department was just getting started, and so he decided to apply for a State Department position. And he did some studying to prepare for the test, and he passed the test. And I think it was 1927 when he began what became, you know, a legendary career.
Mm-hmm. And you would say that, you know, even early on, he had sort of a cynicism about the objectives of idealism in foreign policy.
Yes, he always did. He never had. First of all, was never sympathetic to democracy and when human rights regime started, he never believed in that there were such things as human rights. Mm-hmm. And it took a while. He started out and he realized that this was a way he could make a career. He had to do something, and he did like traveling, and they got him into, you know, being stationed in, you know, Riga and Hamburg and places like that. And he found that he liked that kind of life. He had to adjust himself a little bit because he was a very shy, withdrawn personality, but he realized that as a career officer in the Foreign Service, he really needed to portray a different persona on the public stage.
Mm-hmm. A lot of his what people know him for probably came at the time of the Cold War, mostly. But earlier on, did he have any opinion about, you know, what was happening in World War II that would have made him critical at all? With some of FDR's interests or anything like that?
Yes, he was. I think generally, you know, of course, he thought World War I was the great catastrophe for Western civilization. And he thought there was no reason for that. He knew that World War II was going to be a little hard to avoid, and certainly after the attack on Pearl Harbor. He didn't have much regard for Roosevelt as a leader, war leader. And that got, he thought he was, you know, way too, for one thing, that Roosevelt began to think that he could deal with Stalin, that Stalin was, you know, just a kind of crude version of an American. And so he thought he didn't understand Stalin and the nature of the regime. He also took particularly dim view of the policy of unconditional surrender, both in Germany and in Japan, because he thought that it undercut the anti-Nazi movement in Germany, which he had some contacts with.
So how would you situate him with, you know, people that were much more critical of our involvement, like maybe, say, Robert Taft or anyone like that? Would you consider him in league with that type of foreign policy thinking?
Yes, I think he was basically he was at heart a kind of isolationist, mm-hmm. Which was the sort of the standard view of Americans until the First World War, until the Spanish-American War, we entered in that. And then when Wilson became president, of course, then there was no turning back. But, you know, he thought it was, he knew that at some point there were certain contexts and commitments we made you couldn't get out of. He thought they should be limited, though, as limited as possible to Europe and perhaps Japan. Other parts of the world, he thought we should stay out of and mind our own business.
Did he play any administrative role in Hoover or FDR or anyone before that? Was he part of any administration at that time?
Well, he did have, when he first came into power. No, really, Roosevelt was the first president when he actually began his career. Hoover was still in office, but he didn't have any influence on that government. It was after Roosevelt came to power, and he had been in the Foreign Service for long enough. And he had the advantage that he chose to learn Russian in the Foreign Service, partly because of a relative who has had the same name, George Kennan, and who was sort of an expert on Russia and had been very critical of the Tsarist regime. Mm-hmm. And so he was, he was a handy man to have around. And so he went with Bulat to, when Bulat became the first ambassador to Soviet Russia.
Mm-hmm. What objections did he make to the concept of unconditional surrender?
The main one is that it undercut the anti-Nazi movement in Germany, and he also thought that that you should never set records like that where you can't have any kind of negotiation and see if you can end the war sooner than it did get ended. He thought maybe that not 6 million Jews might have been killed if they had some kind of negotiated peace, or and made clear to the anti-Nazi Germans that if they overthrew Hitler, that they would not be treated as if they were the same as the Nazi regime.
Mm-hmm. After World War II, things began to get heated with the Soviet Union, and he began to participate more actively in foreign policy decisions and interpretation. What did he see in his mind? What was the meaning of our confrontation with the Soviet Union? What did he think was happening?
Well, there were two things to know about his attitude to them. One was that he despised the Soviet regime. He had never had any use for Marxism, unlike many people in his generation and in the State Department. But he did have a great love for the Russian people, and he never lost that love. And so his attitude was kind of a mixture. You know, he'd never mixed up the two, the Russian people and the Soviet regime. And so his attitude was always had this sympathy for the Russian people. And he also, once Stalin was dead, saw possibilities for, in fact, he always believed that eventually the Soviet regime would fall under its own weight. And it turned out he was right about that.
Mm-hmm. Did he see the Soviet Union and international communism as expansionist and threatening to the United States?
You know, only to a certain degree. I mean, he thought that both, he admitted that there was some hangover from the Tsarist era of some kinds of expansionist tendencies. He thought Stalin, though, was an expansionist only, he'd take what you gave him. Mm-hmm. That he was, unlike Hitler, although he was he was every bit as bad as Hitler, but unlike Hitler, he was not reckless. He wasn't a reckless adventurer, and Kennan believed rightly, I think, and I think is the historical record shows us that if you you needed to confront the Soviets with a firmness, but he meant by that political, not go to war every, you know, every time there's a disagreement. Mm-hmm. But to show a firmness and treat it as in a businesslike manner without pretending that we're on a sort of friendly basis with them.
Yeah. Did he was he like a pro Eisenhower?
Generally, you know, he was tended to vote for the Democrats, but that was mostly on foreign policy things when the Democrats were not completely insane. And so he didn't mind Eisenhower so much. He detested Dulles, though, because Dulles was the one who really threw him out of the Foreign Service.
So he was a critic of like sort of the like deep intelligence and the deep state sort of when it was first, you know, gearing up.
Yes, I mean he didn't like found that he didn't like some, you know, CIA business. Although he, you know, he originally had supported, you know, sort of surveillance and the Russian stuff. He came to think that you can't, that it was pointless. You could learn pretty much from published sources what you needed to know, and so he regretted being, you know, enthusiastic about engaging in sort of John le Carré business, and he turned against all that.
Mm-hmm. How would you compare him to the interpretation of people like Joe McCarthy in the Red Scare?
He was very much against McCarthy, and he thought that that there was an excessive fear of domestic communism. A lot of some of his friends came afoul of McCarthy's, like John Peyton Davies was one, and Oppenheimer, of course, and he really disliked McCarthy. On the other hand, you know, he says in his memoirs that you don't want to compare McCarthy with, you know, truly dangerous people. He said, you know, that McCarthy didn't have any, you know, army behind him. He had, the courts were opposed to McCarthy. So he never really, Eisenhower was, although not openly, was hostile to him. The fear of McCarthy was almost as great, unreal as the fear of communism had been. So he had no illusions about communism. He said there, you know, there were sympathizers, and as we know, some communist agents in the State Department. He thought, though, that it was exaggerated, and that McCarthy did more harm than good.
Mm-hmm. What general mistakes or sympathies did he have with the general policy during the Cold War?
Well, always in the Cold War, he thought it was over. Our attitude was over militarized. That that this should be partly because once the Soviets got nuclear weapons, now they're talking about disagreement, you know, hostilities between two nuclear powers, and he thought. After the horrendous bombings that he saw the results of in Germany during the war, and then the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he thought the biggest job of foreign servants and foreign policy in the State Department was to prevent a catastrophic war, which another war would be. So that, he thought, was the most important thing, and to always, you know, and that meant keeping open communication lines with the Soviets and any government, because he said, you know, it's not just keep having relations with governments doesn't mean that you because Americans, a lot of Americans think this, that you approve of the regime that you're dealing with.
Right. I mean, that's the classic realist perspective on that. You know, is you don't have to endorse everybody that you work with.
No.
What would he think of organizations like NATO and some of these more internationalist bodies?
He was opposed to the creation of NATO because he thought it was too militarized. It was a militarization of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. So he was never in favor of it. But there it was. And of course, late in life, when he saw the NATO moving closer and closer to Russia's, the non-Soviet Russia's border, He was horrified by this, a tremendous mistake, which it was.
Mm-hmm. You said a few minutes ago that he was a critic of democracy. So what alternative would you place him in? What did he think positively about government?
He thought, sort of like Plato, he thought democracy was the worst form of government other than naked tyranny. Right. So he thought, Nazi Germany, Stalinist Russia's worse. But other than that, he thought it was really the worst kind of a government. He preferred a kind of authoritarian government that would be non-tyrannical and non-ideological. So he admired, for example, the Schuschnigg government in Austria in the 30s. And he was very much admired Salazar's government in Portugal.
Mm-hmm. Just for realist reasons. I mean, for him, he was really an anti-ideologue.
That's right. He didn't have ideologies. He had a Christian faith. It was heterodox, but it was real.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Was he pretty conservative? I mean, you said that he didn't really go toward Republicans, but that doesn't mean he wasn't a conservative or didn't have some sort of Christian rooting.
No, he was definitely. He often called himself a conservative of the European sort. In an interview he gave with a Hungarian interviewer, a good one, Orban, and he said to him that he was a strange kind of mixture of a reactionary and a liberal. And by liberal, he meant in the Burke Tocqueville tradition. That's what he meant by a liberal. Right. At home, he regarded himself as a conservative. In Russia, he regarded himself as a liberal. He thought that the best forms of government in Russia, the most encouraging ones, were the liberals in Russia. Mm-hmm. But he was. It was very, very hostile to mass democracy and mass politics. And he did think government should be, he thought, for example, that he was opposed, for example, to universal suffrage. Mm-hmm. He didn't oppose, when he was young, he wrote a thing, that was a good thing it wasn't published, where he said blacks and women shouldn't be able to vote. I don't think he would have said that late in life, but I'm sure he would have said, though, he's still opposed to universal suffrage.
Right.
As what Dostoevsky called the greatest superstition of the 19th century. He thought government, there were certain things like local government, he didn't have any objection to democracy, sort of like Solzhenitsyn, because you don't have to have a PhD in political science to know whether you want, another building to go up in town or, But if you're going to talk about international affairs and stuff, this is not for amateur hour. You need people who know what they're doing. And he didn't like the idea. He didn't even like summit diplomacies because he thought most presidents really didn't have the time or the competence to really deal seriously with foreign affairs.
This strikes me as consistent with Paul Gottfried's own interpretation of Kennan, which is that he was very much a paleoconservative. He wouldn't have fit in well with, the post-war conservative incorporated that the neoconservatives took over. He had very much of an old world mentality and outlook on life. Does that come across in his critique of, the American role in the development of post-war Europe, maybe?
Yeah, of course, he was for that. I mean, the development for the, because he helped put together the plan to revive Europe. But that was all to keep Western Europe from going communist. Mm-hmm. So he was for that. Generally, he just would wanted his kind. He told John Lukács once, he said, I like my country to mind its own business. So he thought the less we involve ourselves in other countries, he thought, for example, that you, there's nothing you can do to change the inner workings of other the situation of governments in other countries. Mm-hmm. That it doesn't mean you have to approve of it, but the idea that you're going to be able to change this, unless you're going to go to war over it or and then take over the country or something.
Right. How would you describe the concept of containment? You know, what role did he play in that, and why was it an alternative to the path we did take?
I think the two alternatives, I guess, at the time were his idea of containment and the idea of that other side of liberation, like James Burnham, for example. The trouble with the liberation people, I'm very sympathetic to Hungary, and I was sympathetic with the Hungarian Revolution. I had a good friend who was involved in the revolution, more than one, actually. So I was sympathetic with the Hungarian for their side. On the other hand, Eisenhower could not. There was nothing we could do about helping the Hungarians, really, because it could have led to a war with the Russians. So there's nothing you can do to really change these regimes. You hope that the best we can do is try to set an example of competence and decency, and hope that regimes that we don't like, and sometimes with good reason, would moderate over time, as it did happen in Russia.
Mm-hmm. What did Kennan think about the Vietnam War?
He was opposed to the Vietnam War. He had no use for the Viet Cong. We thought were a bunch of sort of thugs and gangsters. But he was opposed to war because he didn't think there was any national interest of the United States involved. Mm-hmm. And that the war was just what it turned out to be, an ongoing war in which what did we leave 55,000 guys at the, and God knows how many Vietnamese we killed. And for what? I mean, when it eventually went communist in Vietnam, I'm sorry for that. I'm sorry for a lot of people. But it didn't really make any big difference to us. And all the students and the radicals and the things, they had a different view of Kennan's. They were actually for the Viet Cong, mm-hmm. and the North Vietnamese. I had a friend who was a leader of the radicals at Wisconsin in the 60s, and he said, don't let anyone tell you that, we were just concerned about America. So we wanted the Viet Cong to win, So Kennan never had that. He had never illusion about the communists. He just didn't think it was in our national interest to get involved in the war.
Did he see any domestic threat of communism at all? Like, you talked about the radicalization of the universities and the students. Did he see that as something that needed to be addressed?
Well, he did think that, of course, the war did help radicalize young people. I was in graduate school really before this got started, so I wasn't an undergraduate at the time. But a lot of these people, these young people who opposed the war and claimed that they were doing terrible things, actually they didn't want to be drafted. That was really
yeah.
I mean, that's okay. I don't blame them, but. I'd already served my time, and I don't blame him for not wanting to go off and fight in Vietnam, but I disliked the pretense that it was something other than that. I mean,
sure.
And that it was all high-minded stuff like that. And when the war ended, just as kind of predicted, they all forgot about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Right. How would you compare Kennan to someone like Pat Buchanan? Do you think he anticipated Buchanan at all?
Yes, I think he did. I think Buchanan was very influenced by Kennan's work, and they had on foreign policy, they had almost identical views on the situation and the decline of America. I think their ideas were extremely similar. They're almost identical.
Yeah. So did Kennan have any, I mean, Buchanan, obviously, I wouldn't call him a pure populist, but someone who recognized there was a tactic in populism. Did Kennan get into that at all very much, or was he mostly focused on foreign policy?
I think, yeah, it's mostly in foreign policy. I think it would be better to think of him. I wouldn't call him a populist because he didn't have a high opinion of the masses.
Sure.
So I wouldn't call him that. He was an elitist, and in fact, he never denied that. He gave an interview with Eric Severide, in the 70s, I think, he said, "I think Severide asked him something about being an elitist." He said, "Of course, I'm an elitist." He said, Does everybody have to be, sort of moderate nothings, or he believed in elite. I think he would have said about our problem is that not that there's an elite, is an elite, but that the elite is degenerate.
Did he see? What cultural problems did he see in post-war America that maybe would have negatively influenced where Europe was going? Because, you know, today it's obvious that the American elite are very decadent, very morally decadent. Yeah. Did he see any of these trends arising in his time?
Yes, he did. In fact, he saw it a lot older than a lot of us did. He went to California in the 50s, and he didn't like what he saw there. And this was in the 50s, you know. And he said, California is the future of America. It's childhood without the possibility of maternity or maturity.
Mm. Well, I live in California. I see the fruits of his warnings. Did he have any influence on the foreign policy thinking of Richard Nixon?
That's a good question, and he did have, but largely through Kissinger.
Okay.
He was a great admirer of Kissinger's foreign policy and of detente, and so in that sense, he was sympathetic with Nixon's foreign policy, and Nixon's foreign policy was pretty much on the realist line. This is at least in foreign policy, and domestic, he was kind of a standard liberal, but in foreign policy, partly because of Kissinger, partly Nixon himself, who actually knew something about foreign policy.
Right.
So he was fairly sympathetic with that, but again, largely because Kissinger was there.
Yeah. Would you consider Kennan as pessimistic about the 20th century or optimistic?
I think he was pessimistic, yeah.
Yeah, because I was going to set this up by saying, you know, this is the American system in the post-war era has been described as sort of the triumph of history, you know, the zenith of political transformation. Kennan would have dissented from that optimistic view.
Absolutely. He never was an optimist. He was very careful, you know, he was very worried about people reading his writings and listening to him, that he didn't want to leave people in despair. He thought, rightly, that despair is a sin. And he has a great line from Tolkien's great novels, and Lord of the Rings, and where Gandalf says, well, you know, despair is only for people who see the complete end of things. So he didn't want people to despair, but generally he was Spenglerian in his outlook. I mean, he had, he thought that the direction of Western civilization was, and America was not a good one. And it didn't see, you know, a lot of optimistic for the future.
Yeah. He had a relationship with someone you mentioned earlier, John Lukacs. I think that's how you say it. Describe what their relation. You know, how what was John Lukacs seeing at the time, and why did Kennan and him become good friends?
John admired Kennan very much. Let me say that they did have disagreements. I mean, John was definitely a Germanophobe. And for good reasons, that's another subject. Partly because the Nazis almost killed him. Kennan was a Germanophile, always.
Mm-hmm. Like Paul Gottfried is.
Yeah, like Paul is, yeah. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they're completely uncritical. It was completely uncritical or anything, but they generally was Germanophile. John originally, since he admired Kennan different things, that there was excessive anti-communism and things like that. And so John wrote a letter to Kennan. Mm-hmm. Must have been in the 50s, I guess. And they started, and Kennan responded, and they began a correspondence, and it got deeper and deeper and there were more and more letters passed between them. And eventually, Kennan was a very formal kind of person. And John was too. But at some point, you know, Kenan, told him, he started calling him John instead of Mr. Lukacs. And so they began, got on a first name basis, and their friendship deepened after that.
He died in 2005. So did he comment on all, at all about the Iraq War?
Yes, he did. He was very much, he was shocked that we were going to, that what Bush was going to take us into this, start a war there. And he was very much opposed to that. He said, you know, it's not clear to me that we have any idea how we're, once we start this, how we're going to end it and get out of there.
Did he see the Iraq War and the War on Terror as sort of a fruition and a natural development from idealism?
Yeah, I think he did. Because I mean, and Bush made that easy because he was always talking about, you know, democratizing the world and ending evil in the world or something. This is kind of crazy talk, and it it led to these disastrous interventions there. Afghanistan was a little different, although, you know, there there were at least some reason because they were, the Taliban was complicit in the attack on the United States, although I think none of us really signed up for 21 years there. But the Iraqi thing, I think, is pretty much recognized. This was one of the great catastrophic decisions in the history of American foreign policy.
Would Kenan have been surprised at the disastrous outcome of our involvement in the Middle East?
I don't think so. He had a very low view of the Near East, and he, when he had often had to stop over in Iraq on the way to Moscow, and you know, he described as fanatical people have fanatical religion, and people put half the population, the female half, under perennial house arrest. You know? And he said he thought we had no fundamental interest there, we should not be relying on oil from there or anything else. It's not a part of the world where it's too far away from us. We have no fundamental interest there, and we should keep our nose out of there.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall if he was sympathetic to Reagan at all, or was he more critical of Reagan?
He was pretty critical of Reagan at pretty much all the way through, although, and sometimes unfairly, I think. He did not know because he, I don't know if he ever saw Reagan's autobiography. I don't know if he did or not. He thought that Reagan was might lead us into a war. We know that was not true. I mean, that Reagan was very much concerned about nuclear war and wanted to, especially after he was shot, he wanted to devote himself to trying to prevent nuclear war. He just thought he didn't like talk of axis of evil and things like that. So he didn't have a very, but it was kind of thinking that Reagan really was not, he was not competent in foreign policy and was too very, you know, warlike in his atmosphere to the Soviet Union. I think it wasn't completely fair to Reagan, that was his view.
Yeah. I know this is sort of a guess, but what do you think he would have thought of Donald Trump?
Yeah, that would be a guess. Trump, as far as his personality, was not something that Kenan would warm to.
Sure.
I think he would be impressed that although Trump has no foreign policy, you know, studies or background or anything, but he does seem to have good instincts. And unlike the people who are running the foreign policy establishment now, he didn't start another war in the 4 years he was in the presidency. And not perfect, but I think he would be, that Kenan would have given kind of somewhat reluctant praise for him that he at least have good instincts and was not in favor of, you know, pushing, but not so anti-Russian and not looking for wars all over the world, especially in the Near East.
Yeah. So your more recent book is George Kenan for Our Time. So why should people read George Kenan? What does he have to offer us?
Well, I think although his probably no one's very few people are going to listen to him, and that's too bad. But I think he has a lot to tell us about minding our own business, foreign policy, to have a more moderate, more restrained, less ideological foreign policy, and certainly not one to turn the whole world into democracies. God help them. So he's on that. I think his belief that our primary business should be putting our own house in order, mm-hmm. and not be worrying of other people's business. We have enough problems of our own, and that he was very much opposed to egalitarianism of any kind. So he would, unfortunately, egalitarianism is a kind of religion for Americans. It's very hard, difficult to, the idea that you're not, I just heard someone the other day and they said, well, we're all for equality, but something like that, you know. Mm-hmm.
George Kennan would not have agreed. No. Do you think would he have given any particular thought to our immigration policy or crisis?
He did. He thought immigration was a extremely dangerous thing for that it was uncontrolled. He couldn't figure out why people could come across the border with nothing more than the desire to be across. We know now, of course, that it's not a matter that they can't stop, but they don't want to stop it.
Right.
His opposition was he didn't like bringing in a lot of people who would not assimilate and were not capable of assimilating and were going to bring with them totally different culture. His objection was not ethnic identities. It was cultural, and it's true that it's not always easy to separate those, but it's possible to do it. I mean, I think a lot of Asiatic Americans come and they keep some ties maybe with Asia, but they live American lives and they assimilate. But the cultural thing, he thought that it's possible to have a multi-ethnic society. It's not easy, but you can have one. Mm-hmm. We do have one. But a multicultural society, no, you can't have that. And the reason is that there are no agreements on fundamental principles to which you can appeal when inevitable disagreements come along. Mm-hmm. And that means that the only way you settle this is who's got the power, the might, that's all.
Right. So what it sounds like is his realism shows up there in foreign policy, but also in domestic policy too. I mean, he was a realist across the board.
Yes, he did. He was a realist across the board. He would like to have seen the United States, remain pretty much what it was in his father's time. He knew that wasn't going to happen, but he did think that we should be, that first of all, not only about the ethnic and cultural differences, but the number of people that we can handle. He thought that there were, there's a limit to how many people we can take in because it's not just, housing, but I mean, space, so you have, you can't go places where you're not crowded all the time. So he saw, as he and John Lukács agreed on this, that the immigration bomb was really very threatening to the United States.
So if people want to get into George Kennan, obviously you have your two books and I recommend them. But does he have a biography out there? I know he has a lot of his own writings that people should pick up too, but is there anything in particular that you would recommend?
Well, John Gaddis wrote the sort of the authorized biography. Gaddis is a very good historian on foreign policy. And there's a later book out, and I can't remember the professor who teaches in Pennsylvania, which delves into Kennan's personal life more. Both of them are pretty good books. Gaddis, my problem with both of them is that they both are critical of Kennan's anti-democratic instincts and views.
Interesting.
And since I'm not, I found the failure of the books. But you can learn something from them. I think the new book, it's Kennan Between Two Worlds or something, is pretty good. And he tells you something about Kennan's life and some of his faults, which Kennan always admitted to. But we get a little too much of his affairs and, you know, and his faults. And nonetheless, I mean, that was it's fair enough, but it's within limits. And
people just, I mean, that gossipy aspect of American political writing today is it's a little bit overwrought.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, again, I've my own view of writing intellectual history is that it has to be contextual. That is, I don't think ideas exhaust their own meaning, and that you have to be put in the context of the world in which the writer lived, and the personal experiences the writer had. So I'm not unsympathetic with that. I just think that you know enough is enough. You can say that. He did give in to these sexual urges, in which he admitted and felt guilty about all the time. Mm-hmm. It was a character flaw, but having said that, there was much in his character that was very good. For example, even though he was not a Democrat, I know from people when I was at the Institute for Advanced Study who told me about him that that he treated. Everybody, no matter what station in life they were in, treated everybody with respect and decency. And I think I wrote in that first book that I thought he was, all things considered, I thought he was the greatest American of the last century. A reviewer of my recent book said that was unwarranted. Okay, and it was a bold statement. It was, and that it was unwarranted. Okay, but I think he should then say, how about, you know, somebody, you know, tell me who he thinks, you know, is clearly superior to Kennan as an American in the 20th century. And I'm willing to listen, but he didn't tell me who he has in mind. So he just says it's unwarranted. Well then who else? I mean, tell me, give me a name. I mean, but any case, you know, I do think he was a remarkable man and generally, you know, he was a man of a good character and too bad we don't pay more attention to his wisdom.
And he's pleasant to read. You would recommend his memoirs then?
Yes, I do. They're beautifully written. You know, he wrote, you know, he was very much influenced by Edward Gibbon. Mm-hmm. And both his ideas about the fall of Rome, but also the prose. You know, he wrote a kind of, consciously, a kind of 18th century prose.
Right.
And I admire that. Not everyone does, but I think he wrote a beautiful prose, and he really worked hard on his prose, even when he was writing sort of, you know, probably when he sent his shirts out to be careful what he wrote. You know, he was incredibly concerned to try to write nice, clear, beautiful prose.
Yeah, he sort of represents an America that's vanished in so many ways. And sometimes, you know, it's good to get out of our presentism and take a look into someone who thought deeply about our century, the meaning of American foreign policy and the meaning of the American empire. And I don't think you can get that in a more crystallized way than through George Kennan. So I appreciate your time. I appreciate your books. I hope everybody who listening to this gets into Kennan, because he's someone that's a helpful antidote to the craziness that we see in our time. So thank you for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you.